Before we get started with this episode, I wanted to let you know that May is Mental Health Awareness Month. In honor of this, I'm making my signature course, Resiliency Sprint, 50% off just for podcast listeners. You also get lifetime access to CVT Family Toolbox, over 100 activities, resources, and ideas to bring cognitive behavioral tools to your family. Head to childanxietysupport.com/resiliencysprint to learn all about this foundational course. And when you sign up, use code PODCAST to get 50% off both the coached and uncoached versions. This offer is only good till May 31st, so make sure you sign up now. Hey everyone, welcome back to You Are Not Your Mother. I'm excited about this month's podcast. I got to interview Deirdre Pruitt, who is the owner of Reconnecting Columbus, a practice here in Columbus that specializes in couples therapy. Deirdre and I met right when we were both just launching our private practices, and she had big plans even then and a clear idea of exactly the kind of clients she wanted to work with. I remember that we were sitting in a coffee shop talking about what we wanted our dream practices to look like. And even then, Deirdre was really clear. She liked working with high conflict couples, the kinds of couples that maybe had already been through several rounds of counseling and were at the end of their ropes. The people that other counselors might see as hopeless. She's like, bring them to me. I love it. She talks a little bit more about the kinds of couples she works with in the interview, but I think what she has to say here is helpful for anyone. So when I approached Deirdre about an interview, I wanted to hear more about how our relationships with our parents can sometimes complicate things in our relationship with our partners, and she came through. When you listen to this interview, you can see I barely have to ask her a question. She has so much insight and so much wisdom to share, and I think it's really terrific. Now, another thing is Deirdre comes from, she's a Christian counselor, although she works with couples no matter what their belief systems are. But she's upfront about that's where she's coming from. And she said to me, are you sure you want to interview me? Because I know that you are not coming from a Christian point of view. I also can work with a variety of clients, but yeah, I'm not a Christian counselor. I'm not a Christian. And I told her, listen, I want you to bring you to this interview because I think that you have lots to share, and I want everybody listening to find exactly the person that is meant to help them. And so I want the people I interview to show up exactly who they are, to bring in their philosophical points of view, their theoretical orientations, because I think my listeners are smart enough to take exactly what is helpful to them and leave the rest. And so I encourage you to do that with Deirdre. I think what she has to say is helpful for anyone. A couple of times she says, this comes from a biblical point of view. And if that doesn't resonate with you, obviously, both Deirdre and I would say, if it doesn't resonate with you, then it's not for you. But I hope you listen to what she has to say, because I think it's really, really good stuff. Okay, so let's dive in. Hey, thank you for joining me here today. Why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself, about your practice? Who do you work with?
Sure. I'm the owner of Reconnecting Columbus here in Columbus, Ohio. And my clients are traditionally two very strong individuals who are successful in their respective or collective careers. They either run businesses together or are professionals in their own right. And they are having significant trouble in their relationships. A lot of the times they are recovering from infidelity, or they are having a considerable amount of conflict in their relationship. More often than not, they've seen a few therapists and haven't quite gotten what they've needed thus far, and are looking for someone who might be a little bit more opinionated, maybe strong-willed, and usually end up with me and my practice. I'm very passionate about working with folks who have significant work that needs to be done, for lack of a better term.
I'm hoping that you can talk a little bit about the ways that we bring our relationship with our parents into our relationship with our partners and where that gets in the way of our relationship with our partners.
Yeah. The first thing that came to my mind when you said our relationship with our parents and our relationship with our partners is that we pattern, that we have a tendency to pattern the relationship between us and our parents and a relationship between us and our partners. And sometimes we take the inverse position. And then sometimes we pattern the way our parents interact and we might take the inverse position. But there's a lot of good information when we look at the relationship that we have with our parents and we look at our current relationship. Now, the challenge also may come if those two relationships, the relationship with your parents and a relationship with your partner, have some enmeshment or that there's some overlap. If there is not a good, healthy, safe boundary in between the couple bubble, which that's what I like to call the relationship that my couples have, is that they have a bubble and everyone else is outside of the bubble. And if you don't have that bubble as a boundary, then your bubble is not safe. It's not stable. It falls apart. And then we have chaos. So if we are able to create a safe, healthy, stable bubble, then everyone is able to benefit, even if it doesn't feel like they want to, if that makes any sense.
How do we know if our bubble is being violated?
A lot of the times that's a gut feeling. A lot of times those of us who have been wired for guilt from our parents have that weird anxiety, guilt-ridden feeling when we feel that our boundaries are being violated. And that's not any different than if our couple bubble has been violated. So it might feel as though you're being pitted against your partner. And that might be something that's reflective of a boundary crossing. It might be that conversations between you and your parents or your care providers or family members, that those conversations then somehow result in a fight with your partner later. You might even have situations where your partner is asking to be prioritized. And sometimes that's a key. But then very often, if we find ourselves thinking in should or have to or supposed to, when we think about our relationship with our parents, then that too will give us an idea that we might have some issues with boundaries.
What are some common scenarios that you see in family patterns that cause these kinds of problems?
Very often when it comes to a parent who feels entitled to time, energy, space, money, then that child responds to what I need isn't important and I have to put others before me. Because a lot of times if we're wired that way, we're guilted into believing that we are supposed to, there's that supposed to again, that we're supposed to make time, energy, money, whatever available to parents at all times because of a host of different reasons. Then when we get into partner relationships, then that is the expectation that one person is the receiver of time, energy, space, emotion, and one person is the giver. And if you are taught that the giver is validated only by giving, then that has a tendency to show up in your relationship, whether it is expectation or maybe you're attracted to someone who also has the same thought process. Very often, I find that partners have a tendency to be attracted to other partners who have similar familiar trauma. If you have a partner, or if you have been experiencing in your relationship with your parents that kind of aloofness or disconnect, then you don't have a tendency to look for it as healthily in your relationship, if that helps at all. See, now I forgot. I went off on a tangent. Okay.
No, that was good. That's good.
So When you have, let's say that you're an adult child and you have an experience of a parent who says, you should always want to take care of me, or I took care of you, so now it's your job in my old age to take care of me, then that pattern might also play out in your relationship, that you might feel, well, I've given to you, so you have to give to me, or I'm forever indebted to you for, what you've given me, or because of your position in my life. So those patterns have a tendency to transfer over, and lack of boundaries definitely transfers over. If you haven't learned in your parent relationship that it's okay to have boundaries with people you love, you for sure are not going to do that in your relationship.
Many of the people that I talk to struggle to honor their gut feeling. You were saying your gut can tell you because they've been told either directly or indirectly that your gut's unreasonable. You're too sensitive. Your demands are too much. You're too needy. What do you say to someone who is struggling to trust their gut?
I would have them, and I very often do, have them explore guilt and shame. And we might talk about what guilt and shame feel like, particularly shame. Guilt's one thing, guilt's about what you do. Shame is about who you are. And you might want to talk to yourself and figure out, okay, this doesn't feel great. Why doesn't it feel good? And if you can put words around why that doesn't feel good, maybe it's because I should, or I'm supposed to want to do this for my parent. I'm supposed to give or accept. Then a lot of times that's your indicator that something's wrong. So when you have a gut feeling, your gut feeling is there for a reason. That is that part of you that wants to heal. If you listen to that part of you that wants to heal, then a lot of the times you'll move toward healing. But if you are ignoring, crushing, suppressing that little, still small voice inside of you, then that will continue to create opportunity where you can be unhealthy. So if you're a believer and you think about your still small voice is supposed to be your guide anyway, above anyone else's voice, because that's the whisper that you're supposed to be listening for. And if you're ignoring that, then you're not going to get where you're supposed to go. And those are the only supposed tos that I am comfortable with talking to my clients about, is that still small voice that we've learned over time in unhealthy family patterns to ignore.
How does somebody start setting boundaries when the people around you are not respectful of those boundaries?
So the first thing that you have to do is think about what your mindset is. What are you coming into this with? So when you start to set boundaries, you have to first start with you. Why am I setting boundaries? One of my favorite quotes that I use often is, and I'm paraphrasing, but of course your family pushes your buttons, they install them, right? So you have an ex and that's a AA thing, but you have to have an expectation that, okay, if I'm going to create boundaries, it's going to kick up dust. Somebody's going to have a problem with it because they're no longer allowed to run roughshod in your life anymore. And they're not going to appreciate that. They want to be able to do whatever they want to do when they feel like doing it. And here you are with your silly little boundaries trying to make everybody healthy, and they don't really want to do that. So you have to expect that there's going to be a challenge to your boundary. So if you come in with that expectation, then you're not surprised or offended when it happens. And if you realize that it has nothing to do with you, it has to do with them wanting to manage their own wants and needs, and that they actually may not have even considered the effect it has on you, then it's a little bit easier. It's not perfect, but it's a little bit easier to not take that personally. If you come in with this expectation, that's super helpful, and it's not about you. And that the relationship can't be healthy until you're healthy. So you can't live in shame. You can't live in fear and expect that relationship be healthy. That's not going to work. So coming into the thought of, okay, if I want to be healthy, if I want to feel good in this relationship, something's got to change. So that's a mindset thing. And then you also have to decide, and I'm really big with my clients on creating a legacy. You have to decide that you're going to stop the pattern, that your legacy is not going to be this experience just because this is what the way it's always been. So if you come in with that mindset, that's super helpful. And then what do you do with that? Okay, first you have to be clear and unemotional. You can't come into this and assume that your tears or your upset is going to make your family member all of a sudden care about what you're feeling or thinking. They're so wrapped up a lot of the times in what they want that they don't notice you. So when you come in with a clear, unemotional agenda, a lot of the times that will help you to one, feel protected, and two, not get sucked into the emotional tsunami that has been used to control you up to this point.
That makes me curious. So you're talking about being healthy in a relationship that's previously been dysfunctional. Is that something you can do with a partner? Can you be healthy in an unhealthy relationship with a partner?
Mm-hmm. It's hard work, particularly if both of you are used to the dysfunction and unhealthy patterns that you've been stuck in. Many times when we are in an unhealthy relationship, we don't have a picture of health yet. We know we want to feel better. We don't know what that looks like because we don't have any example of that. Very often when I have clients and in the first or second session, I'll ask them, who are their guider couples? Who are the couples that they are looking at patterning their relationship after because those relationships seem healthy or good? And it's very often that they don't even have any. They have no idea what healthy or good looks like. So those decisions to be healthy, a lot of the times have to come from hope. And maybe some guidance in the case of my clients.
How does one find a guider couple? How do they figure out who to model their marriages after?
A lot of the times when I ask that question, grandparents come to surface because grandparents have been married for decades and they seem to have figured it out. That they might bicker or they might have disagreements in front of the family, but it doesn't turn into all-out brawls. And there's not these feelings of embarrassment or fear or hurt when even when they have these little bickers, that they seem to genuinely like each other and enjoy time with each other and feel safe with one another. So when I ask for a guider couple or I ask for a couple that they might want to look at emulating themselves after, those are usually the ones that come up. It's very rarely their own parents, unless their parents have been married for a long time and they're themselves old, quote unquote old. When I think about a guider couple, the reason why I ask them that is because I want to know what about this couple feels good or healthy to you. And then that helps me to determine what they think is healthy, what they're actually trying to get their relationship to look like. So it gives me a picture into that. Now, do we actually use them as guider couples? No. A lot of the times we'll actually over time talk about that particular couple or those attributes, and then we'll be able to tease out what's actually healthy and what's not. And that helps them to build their own relationships in a more healthy way and in a way that honors them as people, individual from those other couples.
What are really common misconceptions people have about healthy relationships that turn out to be fallacies? Or because I think we have a wrong idea, we have wrong ideas in our culture about what a healthy relationship looks like.
Mm-hmm.
What are some common issues that you see come up that are really about having unrealistic expectations?
Oh, the first one that comes to mind as soon as you said that is we never fight. That grinds my gears. The idea that we never fight, like we never have conflict, we never disagree about anything, to me is a red flag. Because that means that you've learned to bury, ignore, disregard your own emotion and your partner's emotion. And that is definitely not healthy. But our culture wants us to believe that conflict is a problem because we don't effectively know how to navigate it.
Do you need to teach couples how to argue sometimes?
Oh, every time. That's one of the biggest, when I write a treatment plan, and I think about objectives to our goals, that is my number one objective toward goal would be healthy conflict resolution. I do work from the John Gottman theory, or John and Julie Gottman theory. And that is one of their biggest pieces, is being able to negotiate conflict, because relationships have healthy conflict. And I tell my clients very often, I would much rather you fight and have a drag out and we have to work through it in session than for you to come to session and say, oh, no, we're great, knowing good and well you're not.
What are the kinds of topics that couples seem to struggle with the most?
Closeness. Reconnecting Columbus is named the way it is because a lot of the times, most of the time, almost all of the time, people are really fighting for closeness. They're really fighting to feel like they matter to someone, that they're being cared for by someone, that they're important to someone. And now it can be wrapped up in sex, money, kids. It can be wrapped up in a lot of different things. But when we pull down all the layers, very often we find that it is a bid for connection. And that's a John Gottman thing, but a bid for connection. And all of the theories that I tend to move toward are based in attachment and knowing that you have this other person that cares for you and loves you. And when that is questioned, that's usually where conflict comes up.
Can you speak a little bit more about your theoretical orientation towards attachment?
Sure. Adult attachment theory is a John Bowlby idea, or at least he was one of the pioneers for it. And it's simply the idea that our attachment to our parents isn't that much different than our attachment to our partners. That call and response, that will you be there for me when I need you, those kind of ideas repeat when we find a lifelong partner, or hope to find a lifelong partner. The way that I describe that to clients very often is the idea of going to the playground as a child. That when you go to the playground as a child, hopefully you have a caregiver who sits on the park bench and watches you. Now, they might not be honed in on you for 100% of the time, but if you get hurt, they come running. If you do something well, they're looking up and applauding you. And they're sitting on that park bench makes you more capable and feel more supported, and you're more likely to go and try new things and learn new things and meet new people because you know that you have that backup or that support system sitting on that park bench. Now, what might happen is that if you don't have a caregiver who's paying attention, then you might get used to, I can't look back to that park bench for someone. I've got to do this all on my own. That creates a problem. Or that person won't even sit on the park bench. They're right next to you on the monkey bars. They're right next to you on the slide. They don't give you any space. So you have a tendency to not do things in the way that you would in a healthy way, to go out and try new things. And that is not too much different than adult attachment theory, that if you find someone that can sit on your park bench, that you are going to thrive versus that person not being on the park bench for one reason or another, and that might pull you back a little. So the idea that I have someone on my park bench helps me to become a healthy individual. And that is a very rudimentary way of explaining adult attachment theory.
So we've been talking a lot about if your attachment issues are getting in the way of your partnership and how you can heal those things and how maybe your attachment to your parents, maybe if there's enmeshment there, that they were the ones who were at the monkey bar with you, that they can get in the way of your marriage. What if your in-law is that person? What if your in-laws are the people who are involved with your marriage in ways that you don't like? How can you, as the daughter or son-in-law, how can you start creating some boundaries if your partner is not interested in doing that?
It's interesting you added that last piece because that was going to be my question. Is your partner interested? Because if your partner does not see that there's a problem, you might have signed up for something that's a little bit more difficult. If your partner finds that this is an issue, then you have a little bit of support. The idea that comes to mind is leave and cleave, which is a biblical idea that you leave your father and mother and cleave to your wife. And it's very heterocentric and all of that because it's biblical. But the idea of, Okay, now that I'm an adult and I am partnering with someone else, that I've created a new family and my responsibility lies in that new family. So if you have meddling, boundary crossing in-laws, then that will get in the way of your new family thriving. So I'll go back to the idea of a couple bubble. So when I'm sitting with a couple and we talk about what it means to have a healthy relationship, we talk about a healthy couple bubble. That if you are in this bubble together, then you're on one another's park bench and you know that you are building a relationship that you can answer that question, will you be there for me when I need you? Then that only works if it's the two of you. It's stretching us too thin when we have too many people that we are managing park benches, that we have too many associations that are that deep. When you choose to partner with someone else and create a new family, that you have to understand that your energy goes into that new family. It goes into your couple bubble. If you have an in-law that is trying to get into that, then that is going to get in the way of solidifying your new family or your couple bubble. If your partner doesn't agree with that, then there's a conversation that needs to happen about their expectations of your new family. Does your new family exist? Or are you going to forever be an extension of the family of origin? Having that conversation about expectations, hopefully before you've decided to partner with them for a lifetime, will give you indication of where this is going. Now, if you don't agree, then you might have a conversation about expectation. I expected when we decided to partner that I would become part of your family and that I would become important. And I have put you in that position. And letting them know that they are so important to you that they have become your new family, and hoping that they will return that expectation, that they will also be invested in that new family, and letting them know that new family is important, that creating a new family is important. If your in-laws continue to push themselves into that new bubble, that means that you, as the partner, have taken a back seat, and that's not the intention of the new family. And if we think about it from a believer perspective, that's not God's intention for your family either.
Where do children go in the couple bubble?
Children are very close to the bubble, but they are not in it. If you think about it, children are sitting on the bubble, they're hanging out there, but they don't get to go in the bubble. Because they need to learn to have their own bubble. And if you don't create a bubble and show them what a strong bubble looks like, then here we are with this in-law problem that they don't know that they are intended to have their own bubble, that they can also build their own relationships and feel loved and supported and cared for by another human being in a healthy way. If you let them into your bubble, then they will forever be in your bubble and will not learn their own.
Can we talk a little bit about the trajectory of a healthy parenting, healthy couple bubble relationship? Because obviously, when children are infants, their needs are pretty great. How can a couple allow themselves to grow and recognize when it's time to push the children over to the surface of the bubble a little more, if that makes sense?
That does make sense. So trajectory is a great word. I like that because there is a shift, right? When they're small, your whole life is around making sure that these little people stay alive. But as they grow and they become, middle schoolers and teenagers, hopefully you would shift as well, that you can no longer treat them as a third grader and expect them to move in society as a high school senior. So they have to be allowed to grow. Well, how do we know that that's a good idea? What's our goal as parents? Our goal as parents are to create functional, healthy, happy individuals, not pieces of ourselves that happen to be able to talk. So if we know that our end game is to create healthy, functional, happy, complete individuals, they can't do that if they are carrying us on their backs. When we think about, okay, what's our end game is healthy individual. What does a healthy individual look like? Someone who can maintain their own job, they can complete education, all that good stuff. Okay, how are they going to do that if they aren't given the opportunity to do so? Okay, then what does that look like in a relationship? If they're not able to create a bond with another person, then they won't be able to create a family. That they won't be able to be open to another partner if their expectation is that their parents fulfill their needs for the rest of their lives. That gets in the way of their trajectory. So they have to be given the opportunity to learn that they are their own individual person, and that their parents are guides as they get older, that they are coaches, and that they can be there if needed, but that they have to learn to create and grow as individuals, that they are allowed to be an individual person and they are not just an outgrowth of somebody else. Because if they learn that they're an outgrowth of someone else, then they will forever be dependent on that person, whether it be for emotion, whether it be for financial, whatever the case may be. And sometimes as parents, we don't realize that we are fulfilling our own needs through our children because we want to feel needed. And that's not fair to our children. So we have to allow our children to learn and love and be loved separate from us. When I see this the most is after the children have launched. So the children have gone off and you've done a great job because you're a great parent and they are independent individuals and they want to see the world on their own. And then the couple is sitting across the table from one another and looks at each other and says, now, who are you? And who am I? And what is this? We have wrapped our whole lives around our goal of being excellent parents and creating these strong individuals who are able to be great members of society. But now I'm a shell because all I've known is doing that. And I haven't created who I am. And then the last thing I'll add to this is also, if we don't allow our children to be outside of the bubble and be independent individuals, then they also start to learn that they are only as good as what other people tell them. That they won't learn that they're individuals, so that they have to be validated by other people. I'm only pretty if he tells me. I'm only smart if she tells me. I'm only important if somebody notices me. And then that becomes an unhealthy pattern, not only in their relationships, but in their lives. I know that was a lot.
So no, that was fantastic. I love it. That's exactly what I want people to hear, that it's not selfish to take good care of yourself in your partnership. It's good parenting. Mm-hmm. So when should a couple seek out outside support? What makes a couple ready for couples counseling?
Of course, I'm biased, right? So I think that all couples should do it. I think couples should do it before they get married. But I also realize that the reason why I don't do premarital counseling is because I cannot convince a couple that is madly in love with one another that there will be issues. So a lot of the times when it comes to premarital work, it's okay, if you hit this point, this might be a good idea, that having conversations about empathy and conflict and expectations are important, but I also know they're only going to get us so far when we are starry-eyed and falling madly in love. I think that it's very important when a couple finds that they're having the same fight often, or that they have a cycle going, right? Okay, we have an argument, now we're silent for 2 days, and then we never talk about it again, that those are all indications that you probably want to get outside help. If you find that you cannot resolve conflict in a way that both of you feel closer or at least feel settled, and you don't have any way to figure out how to do that, that is also a great time to reach out. The last thing we want to do is wait until someone has surprised someone else with divorce papers or are walking out or a affair is revealed, that it has gotten so far that there's this very emergent response. Unfortunately, that's what most people wait for. But my hope is that we find that when we are not able to get over the hump, that is when we reach out for help.
How does someone find a good couples counselor?
It's hard to find a counselor. Now, that's the challenge. I tell my clients very often that the fit is most of the battle. 70%, somewhere I read, probably Gottman. Success or failure is the fit with the counselor. So you might have to try on a few and see if they fit. Now, you might be able to figure out what's more likely a fit, and that might be from reviewing their website. We have two therapists that work within the Reconnecting umbrella, and they have 15-minute consultations for free. So you get a chance to have a conversation with them and see if they fit. So you want to find things that they've written. If they've written things, you want to talk to them individually if you can. Yeah, referrals are great, but it has to be a referral from someone who knows you. It can't be the lady that does your hair, or although she might know you well, or someone who is on a list at church. That's probably not going to be the best way. Your best way is that you're going to have to do some legwork. But if you invest in doing the legwork to find out more about a particular clinician and find out if they might be a good fit or not, then you'll get the potential benefit. A lot of my clients say that when they read a blog or something of mine, that they say, oh, no, she knows me. She wrote this for me. That's how it's a fit. If you have that kind of response, then you know that this is probably going to be the person that's going to be able to help you.
What if you feel like this is the right person for us and your partner's, I don't like them?
And that could be a thing. Sometimes you have to default to who your partner is going to be comfortable with if you don't have a strong reaction, because you're going to be more likely to get a positive result. If you are both really strong about that, then you might want to try both and see how it goes, really. If a therapist should be able to handle if you decide that they're not a good fit. And if they can't handle that, then you might want to question it. But if you are, I really like this person, but the success of this work is more important than me getting the therapist I want, I would lean toward, if your partner has a strong reaction, toward another therapist to go with that one. And that's self-sacrifice. And I know that's hard. But if you go into a counseling relationship and your partner's, I don't really like this person, I don't care if they are a freaking rock star, your partner is not there for what you want them to be there for. So that is where your compromise might need to take place.
I know that I've had clients who have been reluctant to seek out couples counseling because they're afraid of having their partnership judged. Mm-hmm. As a couples counselor, can you speak to that fear?
Yeah. I would be lying if I said that will never happen, because counselors are human beings too. I will say, if you feel that your partnership has a potential to be judged, and we all have aspects of our partnerships that might be judged, let's be honest. But if you are really concerned that might be an issue, listen to that and seek out a counselor that is at least somewhat educated about the partnership that you're bringing to the table. If you are in a poly relationship, then you want to seek out a counselor who has had experience with poly partnerships or poly relationships before. So you want to... Or if you have a power dynamic, you want to be able to reach out to those folks. So you want to look for folks who have something like that in their profile, or have written blogs about it, or put information about it on social media. You want to look for someone who proactively shares information about the things that are important or that are relevant in your particular relationship.
I want to make sure that people listening know, you love working with high conflict couples. You love working with couples that other therapists may shy away from. You like working with couples that maybe other clinicians might think things are hopeless. Can you talk a little bit about why you like working with the hardest couples?
I actually fell into that because even in internship, there were a lot of couples that because no one wanted to take them because no one could handle them. And they would end up in my lap because I was the intern. And I found that I was actually really successful with those couples. And even before I graduated, I became the go-to. I was the last stop. That hasn't changed. I find an immense reward in watching a couple who feel like this will never work transition to, oh, we were never that bad. That lights my fire. If I, because it tells me, it shows me how amazing the human spirit is, that we are willing to fight for the things that we want, and we just need help on how do we fight for it correctly. But when I see that couple make this transition, and then they end up being stronger than they've ever been before, because that energy that they use to fight each other, they use to fight for each other. Oh my goodness. I just, that lights my fire. That gets me up every morning. But getting them there, that's where a lot of therapists struggle, is how do I get them there when they are fighting me tooth and nail to destroy this marriage with every statement they make? And it just takes a tenacity and a little, okay, a lot of hard-headedness, and I just happen to possess that. And I look for other therapists who do the same, and that is how Reconnecting Columbus has grown.
So basically what you're saying is you don't think a couple is ever hopeless if they commit to the work.
Agreed. I don't think that anyone is hopeless. And it's interesting because the couples that are attracted to me have a tendency to be power couples. So they, like I said before, have grown businesses or have professional careers that they've had to work really hard for. So they understand the idea of making something out of nothing or having to fight for something for a long period of time. They have tenacity, they have intention, they understand goal setting. So it's just taking those attributes and switching them over to a relationship realm and being able to allow them to find their strengths in that too. That's what makes the difference.
I was just about to say, you sound very strength-based in your approach.
Extremely so, that I'm going to find that thing. A lot of people who come to me, a lot of clients who are referred to me, particularly from other therapists, have this label of antisocial or narcissistic. I don't necessarily believe that you would be in a long-term relationship if this is true, at least not one healthy enough to want to come to therapy as a couple. So I do believe that those, that parts of those diagnoses, that tenacity, that lack of empathy, that those were actually needed in order for you to get where you go, where you got. So a lot of CEOs have a tendency to fall into those categories of narcissistic or antisocial. But what I found is that when I have two people who are coming to me and saying, listen, we want this to work, we just don't know how to do it, that I can use those attributes and pull out what is what's helpful for them in this situation, and then show them how to use it in these situations. That even those antisocial, quote unquote, or narcissistic, quote unquote, individuals who actually had to use those attributes to gain their acceptance or success, that those are actually ways that they have learned to be in order to get where they are. And that is not an innate, pervasive dysfunction of their psyche, if that helps at all.
It does. And I'm not sure if I'm going to leave this part in, but I think it's important.
Okay.
Many clients come to couples counseling wanting to use their insurance, and they don't understand that in order to do that, there needs to be an identified client and a diagnosis. Can you explain that about insurance and explain why you have chosen not to take insurance?
Yes. Insurance is based on a medical model. So it looks at, is there a medical necessity for the treatment that's being provided? A relationship from a medical model is not a medically recognized entity, that an individual can have a challenge that needs treatment, but we don't treat relationships from a medical perspective. You don't have a pill that you can take for a relationship. So when an insurance company looks at a relationship, they say that's not medically necessary and most of the time won't cover it. Now, what usually happens if it's going to be covered is that one individual has to have a medically necessary diagnosis, depression, anxiety, adjustment disorder, whatever the case may be. And then they receive that diagnosis and they have treatment, and that treatment might include their partner being present. So it makes them the identified patient, quote unquote, and that their partner is part of their treatment. So it doesn't actually allow for the relationship to be treated, that it is not an entity. Now, as anyone that thinks from a systemic perspective, we can't look at this one person is broken and I'm going to use the other one to fix them. That doesn't make sense. We look at, okay, the relationship is the challenge, not one person or the other, because inevitably, even if it's 90-10, both people have a part in the way the relationship is right now because they're both in it. So the relationship is the client and you treat the client. That's not a medically recognized client. So insurance companies aren't going to look at it that way. I, as from an ethical perspective, do not feel that it is appropriate to give treatment to one individual using another one. Nor do I think that it's okay to tell an insurance company that this person has a diagnosis and, oh, by the way, their partner might show up. That's not okay. And then if it ever comes out that you actually had two people in the room or that you were treating the relationship when you told the insurance company that you were treating depression, then they have a tendency to claw back all of the money that they've paid toward that treatment. And then the last part of it is a challenge for me individually when it comes to insurance companies is that they also like to tell you how to do things. They like to tell you how long you're allowed to do it, how often you're allowed to do it, and what you're allowed to use. Now, it's interesting that I went to school for all these years, but they are willing to tell me how to do what I do. I see clients for 90 minutes, and that's not allowable through insurance because they feel like I should be able to, quote unquote, fix all of the issues in this relationship in a 50-minute period. And that I can only see them once a week to do that, to undo decades of habits and patterns in a 50-minute session once a week. That's not possible for me. And then they don't like the way I do it. They don't like the idea that a relationship involves two people, that in their idea, you are only treating one person. So one person in the relationship is the problem and you just need to fix them. So we have some difference of opinion. So I decided that the insurance company can go down their road and have their opinion, and I'm going to go down mine.
I really appreciate that because I've talked to clients who have used their insurance for couples counseling and did not know that one of them had a diagnosis and was the identified client. That was something that the clinician didn't share with them.
Oh,
Yeah.
yeah. Now, if that, then there you go as a clinician. Now you've put yourself in risk of having to pay back all that money. And they're not going to tell you ahead of time that you're going to pay it back. They're going to take it out of your account and then send you a letter.
The other thing that happens then is divorce. And all of a sudden, oh, you didn't realize they diagnosed you with the depression and they called you borderline, and that's in the records now, and that's going to go to court.
Yeah. Or you try to go get insurance or, oh, there's all kinds of.
Love what you said too about you're not an extension of your family of origin, you're your own family, and same with your kids. And I can't remember the term you used, it wasn't extension, but I made note of it because you were like, and they're supposed to build their own family too. I tell my clients, and I tell my kids this too, parents are supposed to love their kids more than the kids love their parents. It is supposed to be that way because we are supposed to keep them alive. But they are supposed to not want to spend time with us at a certain point. Yeah. And I tell them, you want your kid to come back for Thanksgiving because they enjoy you and they enjoy time with you and not because you have guilted them into it, which
Oh,
means that
that's so good.
sometimes they're not coming back for Thanksgiving and you better have a good time without them.
I'm like, wait, who said? Show me in the rule book where it said. Yes, the Bible says honor. It does not say handicap. That's real. You see, that's not, I tell people very often, love is not permission. Love does not mean that you have permission to act a complete ass in my life. Matter of fact, love is the complete opposite. Love is about, I love you so much that I want to see you grow.
And there you go. That is my interview with Deirdre Pruitt of reconnectingcolumbus.com. I encourage you to check her out if you'd like to learn more about her and her practice. She is a group practice now, and she says she hires rock star therapists. So do look and see who else she has brought on board. They are licensed in several states, so do check them out if you are looking for someone to support you and your partner. Because we talked so much about boundaries in this episode, I want to make sure that you know about the Bounded Compassion course that I'm launching on May 10th. It comes free with your membership, or you can buy it as a standalone course. This is a 6-week course, and it has weekly lessons and assignments, and it's very practical. We'll be digging into a specific situation you're struggling with, whether that's with your boss, your partner, your friends, your parents, or even your kids. We have several people who are attending who, like me, have an adult child. And I know that navigating boundaries with your adult child, that's a whole nother ballgame, right? I'm going to offer this course twice a year. I'm going to offer it in the spring, sometime around Mother's Day, because Mother's Day brings up a lot of boundary issues for those of us who have complicated relationships with our parents. And also, I'll be offering it again just before the holidays because, oh boy, do we all need to work on boundaries around the holidays. If you'd like to get in on the spring session and you're listening to this before May 10th, then you can go to youarenotyourmother.com/bounded-compassion and go ahead and enroll. Again, it's free with your membership, or you can buy it as a standalone course. And if it's after May 10th, but you want to be sure that you find out when the next session will launch, then go to that same URL, youarenotyourmother.com/bounded-compassion, and you'll see a sign up to get notified when the course launches towards the holiday season. I really appreciate you spending your time with me. Reach out to me if there's anything I can do for you. Follow me on Instagram and DM me if there's something you'd like me to cover in an Instagram Live. I'm enjoying coming on there and answering quick questions. Or feel free to email me at dawn@youarenotyourmother. I hope you'll subscribe and rate this podcast. That helps us get seen by other people. And share it with anyone who you think it might help. Okay, everyone. Thanks so much for listening. Bye-bye.